Welcome to Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode 2, and it's the extension of Japan on Fire 6-1, the aftermath of Japan on Fire 6-1.
And that's a lot of numbers.
Yes. And it's a lot of after and aftermath and what have you. But what we said on the show we were going to do is to do a bonus episode reviewing an Australian sci-fi movie connected to Angel's Egg, which sounds very unconnected, but as you'll hear in these next 30-40 minutes or what have you, it's very much connected. And it's a movie called In the Aftermath, and with the additional title underneath it, The Angels Never Sleep. And it's a sort of 50-50 mix of footage from Angel's Egg, legally acquired footage, mixed with live-action footage by the Australian crew, where they make essentially a post-apocalyptic movie where our Earth is in a state of despair, and an angel descends to help the survivors. That's the easy plot. That's as much as I understood from the movie. That's already signaling my dislike of this movie. But it's a curious piece that.
Indeed.
An Australian sci-fi movie, out of all things, a low-budget one, mixes in Angel's Egg. But John, did you at all find any information out there on this? Is there anything in the Brian Rue book that we referenced in the main show?
Not so much about the film. I mean, obviously, Brian mentions the film in his book on Mamoru Oshii. But basically, he just talks about the film itself and sort of the awkwardness of it, you know, as well as, of course, the synopsis, as you've pretty much synopsized it right there. Mm-hmm. I think what I was trying to do myself was trying to do some research on it, and I contacted some friends of mine who are pretty well versed in things like New World Pictures, American cinema from the 80s and 70s, you know, those kinds of people. And I actually wasn't able to find anyone who I actually found people who had actually watched it, and, you know, they said, oh, yeah, that film, you know, kind of like in a sort of disparaging manner of sorts. So I thought I would try to contact the director himself, Carl Kolpert. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten a reply from him as of yet, but if I do receive anything from him, I will pass that along to you, Kenneth, and you can probably put that in whatever show notes you have for this, or maybe put this in a post-mortem on your website in fact, reply. It's kind of interesting.
I like the initiative, John. You're doing much more work than I would ever thought of was needed for this movie. I'm not saying that bad movies should receive no attention, but my instincts were not of that kind. So good on you. I'll tell you, I take something away from that, John. That inspires me to think a little next time.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just takes a little email here and there, you know. I mean, it's not like I spent hours and hours at the library researching it. maybe total amount of time, like 15 minutes, like getting answers from people and then thinking, well, maybe I should try to contacting the director himself. He's actually now a producer in his own right. He's got his own production company by the name of Cineville. Mm-hmm. And before that, he's worked with as a producer at like Sony as well as TriStar. In fact, he was basically responsible, or at least partially responsible, for getting Allison Anders, the famous American indie director, getting her on the map. He produced a couple of her earlier films in Gas Food Lodging, as well as Mi Vida Loca, which are both kind of famous American indie films from the early 90s. But anyway, back to the film. I mean, again, we're not exactly sure how this production came into being. What we can, I think, surmise from this production for sure is that they had, and they meaning New World Pictures, had acquired the rights somehow to Angel's Egg before this In the Aftermath project came to being. And you said that it was acquired legally, and it certainly seems to be the case that...
Yeah, I mean, it's New World Pictures. I assume that they weren't playing unfair. And I mean, they are pretty open with crediting the original creators, obviously, Oshii. So it's not like they tried to sneak it under the radar.
True. Very true. I think it's kind of curious, though. I mean, the main thing that I was curious about with this production is exactly why the animation was acquired, because I'm thinking it might have been acquired like in a package, you know, with other productions or other films possibly, or possibly one of the producers saw this animated film and thought it was really cool and thought, you know, why don't we acquire this and try to make this into something a little less abstract and a little less a little more of a, I guess, entertaining experience. Yeah. Not to say that in the Aftermath is altogether a better product than Angel's Egg, but I think it seems like it's a result of someone trying to create a more palatable story out of the footage from Angel's Egg. Mm. So
That was my main question, really, when watching it.
Right.
But I wanted so much some insight into what... Did someone just have the vision when watching the Angel's Egg? I know, let's mix animation and live action and make a post-apocalyptic movie our way. You know, it's kind of fascinating to think of how the vision went, or you can flip it too. Mm-hmm. Was there at all any clear, sober train of thought when putting this together? You know, so speculation like. Mm-hmm. Japanofire 6-1 really was when we tried to interpret Angel's Egg. Now we're continuing to speculate what it all is in this case. Why?
I think it was a very calculated thing. The reason is because if you watch the film In the Aftermath, and of course if you know Angel's Egg itself, you can see that, you know, they, for one thing, they chop up the storyline of Angel's Egg and they basically reorder it into a story unto itself. Mm-hmm. So in comparison, I think, because I know I'm not probably explaining this particularly well, but I think for a lot of Asian film fans, and I believe you guys did an episode on this particular film, I think a parallel would be Shogun Assassin. So Shogun Assassin.
Right, we haven't done an episode, but yeah, I certainly do know that movie's history.
Right. And basically what that is the producers of that film were able to purchase the rights to the original film entitled Lone Wolf and Cub, which has been released in its original form on DVD. I think it's through Animego, if I remember correctly, but don't quote me on that. But anyway, Shogun Assassin was a result of these producers purchasing these first two films, or the first film and then half of the second film of the Lone Wolf and Cub series, and basically sort of remixing those two elements together into a story unto itself. Mm-hmm. And I think this In the Aftermath was sort of like a similar sort of approach to production. So it's sort of like, okay, well, we have this story. What can we work out of this? Okay, well, and, you know, if you look at I know you didn't synopsize the film in full, but if you look at how they changed the story of Angel's Egg, and that, you know, the girl is very quite literally an angel in the aftermath. And then the person, the man who we identify as a warrior from Angel's Egg, he's actually cast as her brother.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and they've come down from heaven, supposedly, to help humans. And part of their helping humans is, you know, the girl has this egg and she can bestow this egg upon the humans so they can, you know, help themselves, so to speak. You know, I guess you could say. And I think that because... It feels very calculated how they sort of cut up Angel's Egg and remixed it into a regular story and then incorporated it into the live action. It makes me feel as if the order of this production was, one, acquiring Angel's Egg as the animation, two, was someone sitting down watching this animation and thinking, okay, how can this be ordered into a more traditional, so many act story, four act or three act story or whatever, yeah. How can we work out an arc to this story? And three was thinking, okay, we have an arc to this story, but you know what? The problem is that, you know, with all this footage that we've kind of excised, cut out and reordered, you know what? We only have like about 30 minutes of a film. So, you know what? Why don't we make a live action film and sort of put these elements all together? It'll be really kind of interesting, possibly. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm just, of course, sort of theorizing, but I think that's probably how the production went, at least from, you know, what I've, you know, I've watched the film now twice, unfortunately. I watched it a second time because I didn't want to forget like some key scenes from it. Not that they're really.
It's certainly a valid explanation of if you know how certain movie productions work, like you just described with Shogun Assassin and all of that. So you know, it seems very valid, but still very odd. I've never seen anyone attempt, to remix animation and live action in this. It's very pronounced, and certainly beforehand I was so intrigued,
right?
You know, knowing this existed and that they did this, and right. It's a movie virtually unknown as well, and it's probably never going to be very much known because I don't know how you what you think, John, but I don't think there's any that this movie will ever come out on DVD and Blu-ray, because there's certainly no. New World Pictures, I don't know if they have folded up, regardless, the rights surely have expired and they can't really release this anymore.
It's probably, I would guess that, you know, New World is not really around anymore, and they've and all their properties are spread out amongst, you know, different studios. And my guess is that this particular film is in complete licensing limbo, you know, which means that they'll probably never get an official release again unless someone actually. Well, I would say one of two things. One is if it somehow gets into public domain, or second thing is if, you know, the director himself maybe just says like, hey, I want this, you know, this, I'll give you this much. I kind of doubt he'll do it, but, you know. But I think really my note on this particular production in general is that, and I'll read it verbatim, what I wrote down at the end of the film when I watched it the first time, is that it's safe to say that if neither Oshi nor anime had ever become as big as they have, this film would have been completely lost to time. Mm-hmm. But I think that as it stands, you know, because anime is as popular as it is, and Oshi is a basically a household name in the anime community, you know, whether you like him or not, I mean, you know who he is, right? Mm-hmm. I think from those two facts alone, I think this In the Math really can only be seen as some sort of, like, a curiosity piece.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's the biggest sort of positive I can say about the film, that I like to think of it as, the thought of it amuses me. And sometimes that's true for many movies, the trivia and the curiosity factor. That's amusement, but watching certain movies, certainly this one, it's not enough amusement to go ahead and rewatch it.
No, yeah, definitely. I would say it's not only just a curiosity, it's a misguided curiosity. Yeah. So, you know, I think this is one thing that, in the main episode, I was kind of talking about the direct-to-video market, you know, and I think one thing that we kind of forget a lot, especially now it's, I mean, everything's post-mortem, but, you know, there are a lot of people out there who collect VHS, you know, as either, you know, just a personal obsession or some kind of hipster hang-up, whatever reason it is, right? Yes. Some people really like video, and there are people who specialize in direct-to-video. One thing you have to remember about this market, you know, as it stands now, again, as sort of like looking back and reflecting on it, is that, you know, I think there's a lot of romanticism towards direct-to-video because there was a lot of, you know, sometimes really good stuff and some real bad stuff that's really, you know, so bad it's good, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, like the 80s action is, you know, is something that a lot of collectors always treasure, you know.
Yeah.
But one thing that a lot of people kind of forget is that there's this underbelly to the direct-to-video market, which was there are a lot of these pictures, and I think In the Aftermath sort of fits in this category, that were sort of pretentious and dull.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this In the Aftermath isn't as pretentious as some of the other direct-to-video, like, art house type of films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly trying to be a little bit more than just a B film, even though in the end, that's basically how it and what it ends up being. You know?
I mean, moving into sort of a little bit more discussion about the film, I'd like the good things out of the way first, because I'm going to be real honest. It, for maybe 20 minutes, it kind of sparked my curiosity watching this movie when I didn't, you know exactly how it was going to play out. I mean, it again, the lasting power is that it is a curiosity, but there's also, speaking of something that is not maybe the main component to speak of first, but I'll speak of it anyway. Anthony Moore's ambient score is usually quite spot on and atmospheric, and even if a bit overbearing at points. And the piano number in towards the end of the film is absolutely horrible. If that was indeed Anthony Moore's composition.
Not just a piano number, but it's a song and dance routine, basically.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, and it's so oddly set up because it's, you know, you mentioned this is basically a post-apocalyptic film, and, you know, the characters are running around in these anti-radiation suits.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the characters, who, the male, I forget his name, I think his name is Frank, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, either Frank or Goose. No, it's Frank is the main character, and Goose was someone else.
Right. So he's trying to, like, display his affection toward one of the female characters. So, you know, he's going to sort of woo her on the piano, right? So he puts on his mask, you know, this gas mask, you know these anti-radiation suits. It's like a full headgear gas mask type of confusion. And then he's goes outside of the safety zone where they have oxygen into this, you know, polluted zone just to play the piano. And it just so happens this particular piece is called Carnavalito Tango, which is a piece by a composer by the name of Horacio Moscovici. So,
all right, okay.
So he's playing this piece, which is kind of a jumpy piece. And then, you know, we see this sort of like overlay of this like dancer, you know, and the which has no real relation to the film. It's almost like you're in like music video land.
And there's some lovemaking in between between that. I don't know if that was evoking some, by that point the movie was just a head scratcher for me. I don't know if that was fantasy evoking memories, and they cut in obviously the girl from Angel's Egg watching down from Animated Heaven. And right. Okay, well, so okay, the ambient score, pretty good. The piano number, absolutely horrific. And then
it's kind of like, it's not as a piece, it's an excellent piece. I mean, it's a very complex tango, you know, but it just seems so inappropriate for the moment, you know. Yeah.
Lasts like for an eternity, it seems like. That montage, but I certainly, I mean, we've spoken about this quite a number of times, but ambient scores are really something that's starting to be frequent in my movie watching, you know, habits now, especially from Japanese movies. I've always loved, you know, the genre. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of the UK ambient techno group, The Future Sound of London.
Oh, of course, yes.
So I mean, I like soundscapes, I like ambience, regardless if it's frightening or soothing or what have you. I think it works very well for movies, too, when used correctly, obviously. But here it's fine. It's better than it needs to be, obviously.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely, I'm a big fan of soundtracks. You know, more so scores than, you know, soundtracks nowadays are basically just licensed music from, you know, popular artists, but you know, scores are the things I listen to the most.
Definitely. And another good point, maybe the final one, is that you you're kind of reminded nicely during the beginning how atmospheric Angel's Egg was, because for the first 5-10 minutes, it's mainly footage cut up, though, obviously, from Angel's Egg, and the curiosity is still there about how will they break this up, how will they transfer it into live action, and what will it be like. And then it all derails, because it's so oddly inserted, the voiceover from the angel, the internal dialogue, and then the brother arrives, and then the story is there. Obviously, okay, you're setting up the story, fine, but it seems so oddly, oddly inserted. They don't give off a good confident feeling about, here we are trying to form this story. Are you with us?
Right.
No. I think it's odd, and it's not fantastically dubbed either, the Angel's Egg footage. It's very oddly dubbed, even worse than normal anime dubs. I thought it was the brothers, and she was it sounded like a robot.
Yeah.
Dubbed him. I'm reading the dialogue like this.
Right. Well, most likely what happened was they got someone, like someone's kids, oh, hey, let's get the gaffer's kids to get in here and read the lines or something like that, Mm. Actually, my note on this particular aspect of the film was that I put, in the aftermath is a mix of animation and live action, but Who Framed Roger Rabbit need not worry about competition. because it's rare when there's any kind of interaction or when animated and live characters are in the same frame together.
Yeah.
And it's disastrous when they are, because the animation just does not look well with the live action when they are actually together, in the same frame. Mm-hmm. It basically looks like cutout figures. I was thinking kind of like of A-ha's famous music video, Take On Me, back then it was pretty cool. And, even now it's still kind of cool, but it's very papery, And in A-ha's case, that's the point of the look. But in the case of In the Aftermath, it looks really terrible, when those animated characters are basically slapped over the live action ones.
And then transformed into live action themselves when we get the live representation of the girl. And I think that's one of the, it obviously doesn't work either. And I think everything that they take from the animation and make into live action looks plain goofy and silly, including the egg when they're walking around with the egg towards the end. When Oshii created this, it was kind of a intriguing object. You could sort of look at it and be curious. And when these in their gas masks are walking around with the egg towards the end specifically, it looks just dumb and laughable. So I don't know. It needed to be animated, the story of the egg, I guess, in this case, and not intrude in real life. But I don't know how you felt, John. How long were you? Did you feel this was coherent, this story? I know that I probably was lost after 30 minutes, and then it all was abstract to me.
I thought, as a whole, after I finished the film, I thought that the storyline was coherent enough. The problem I have, and this is a problem I have with a lot of films, is that, while I'm watching the film, I guess it's sort of like a mixture of expectation and anticipation. It's like, you have this feeling that, there's going to be something more to the story than this. It's like, I'm getting the idea, okay, she's supposed to be an angel, and that warrior character from the animation is supposed to be her brother, and they're sent down to Earth to try to save people, and here's this post-apocalyptic setting, and, there's just people walking around trying to find oxygen, this kind of thing. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm sort of following this. It's a bit bizarre, it's not the most coherent of setups exactly, but at the very least I'm following what's going on. There's going to be some scene later where, she saves them or something like that. Sorry if I spoiled the film for anyone
in this case, John, I don't think you need to worry.
So anyway, I'm just sort of anticipating that there's going to be something along the way that is going to be interesting. And then by the end of the film, I kind of realized, you know what? Nothing really happened beyond what I already imagined was going to happen. So,
yeah, exactly.
And I think that's why I would say one problem I had with the film was that even though it's not that long, I think it's only 70 minutes or 80 minutes or something. It feels
longer. It's 70. It's 73, which is wonderful beforehand. You know, only 73 minutes. You only want to watch it.
And you have to remember that, a decent part of that is dedicated toward that song and dance number, the piano part. Was talking about, that's probably about 5 minutes or so. So you could tell they're probably really reaching for padding, you know, and I think there is a lot of padding in this. You know, it's like there's parts where you're just like, okay, I know that they're walking around in the post-apocalypse, but can we get the movie rolling a little faster, please, you know, like that.
I mean, and that is early on as Frank and Goose, whoever Frank and Goose were, are walking around trying to find water and oxygen. And certainly for a while, you know, they are providing low-budget solutions for the post-apocalyptic world, But, you know, it's not too bad walking around this industry setting. It's fine, but it clearly drags after a while. And there's certain, you know... things in the foreground and background of people, dead people presumably still sitting in chairs outside and even in the office space that they're walking around. So that certainly evokes something, but quickly you realize that this scene goes on and on and on and on, just sweeping sweeping the area for oxygen and water and from animated heaven the angel is looking down and I mean, despite this story being now all of a sudden explained to us, I was longing for the, you know, personal interpretation mode that you were in when watching Angel's Egg.
I don't think there's really anything you can do in terms of interpretation. You know, I think it's basically what you see on screen. I just want to back up a little bit and talk about, I was talking about, you know, how the film feels padded. One of the things that's kind of funny is that some of the animation resequencing kind of adds to that padding, you know. For example, like, you know, we've already established that the girl's supposed to be an angel, that she has this egg that she can bestow upon people to help save them, and you know, that warrior character is supposed to be her brother, right? And you know, part of the film is dedicated toward you know, in the original Angel's Egg, that you know, he breaks the egg, right? And we sort of establish, you know, our interpretations of that particular action in Angel's Egg. Now in the aftermath, you know, that scene is also used, but the thing is that it's played out, it's reordered such that, like, she's an angel, you know, and the subtitle, remember, of the film is Angels Never Sleep, right? So she's an angel. Somehow she falls asleep, and he gets angry and breaks the egg. But then she gets another egg. You know, it's kind of like, well, that's not really necessary to have. I mean, I guess it adds a little drama to the story. You know, if you think like, okay, angels are never supposed to sleep, right? So she shouldn't sleep. So her punishment is it. But really, it has no bearing in the story, because she gets another egg and she gives it to the humans, and there's nothing really, there's no consequence of that, of the action of her sleeping, really, you know. Except to, you know, put in an extra maybe 5-6 minutes, because that sequence, you know, is of course, you know, a little slower than because it was artistically shot by Oshii in its original form. You know, it's a little slower. And the funny thing is that, you know, about the subtitle, you know, my note on this was that, you know, yeah, angels probably should never sleep, but, you know, maybe they should just die. Because this is not really a film that I would recommend checking out. No, unless you're really curious about it.
Yeah, I mean, and I was, and I wasn't certainly, you know, expecting, you know, an IFD-style fun and goofy product, because... Right. Just because it mixes footage and all of that, but you know, I'm glad to have had the experience. But it's you know, we mentioned during the main show that certain viewers of Angel's Egg could interpret it in the sort of say deep way that we attempted, or some would say this is pretentious garbage. in the aftermath is definitely towards that character. You know, it's mm-hmm. at times very pretentious, and it certainly is garbage and it's boring. And despite being even more explicit, it's even more muddled to boot. So you know, I say muddled despite the whole ending, the final 10 minutes being very explicitly explained to us. But you know, as you said, it doesn't matter if we're helped along in terms of we don't get any aha moments. Now it means something. It's just apparently, and the end, and they are all happy. Apparently, I don't know. I don't feel anything.
Right? Yeah. It's like you kind of. It's not like you don't really care about the characters. Well, I guess, yeah, you don't really care about them. It's just, yeah, the ending just feels kind of like, oh, okay, that happened. Yeah. You know, and I think that's one of the issues, is that if you could really feel a little more sympathy towards the characters, mm-hmm. and that's kind of hard to say because, you know, you're thinking these are humans in a post-apocalyptic world. You should really care about them. But mm-hmm. in the end, you know, there's... You know, it's such a low-budget film, and in many ways, I mean, the director himself, this was his first film directing. You know, he was straight out of the American Film Institute, where, you know, he got his filmmaking education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure he was given this project. I don't think he had any say in how it was written and everything. And, you know, it's just like, you know, I'm trying to do the best job I can with the budget that I have, but yeah. in the end, it just doesn't come off as being convincing, and the performances definitely don't come off as being very, you know, heartfelt or anything. You know, it's definitely amateur hour in that aspect. So that's sort of what adds to the issue of, you know, should we care about the film in the end? You know, if it had a larger budget and it had more expert direction to it, you know, maybe it could have come out a little bit better. But, you know, it's a New World Pictures production by a young director and amateur actor. So, you know, what more can you say about besides that, right?
Did you at all know of this movie like a few years ago via, you know, the rumor mill, or this was a fairly new discovery for you?
No, I had heard about this film before because I'd heard about Angel's Egg and, you know, from reading Brian's book. You know, even more so, I was sort of a little curious about it. But I had heard about it before through, I think it was just mainly through friends who are just, you know, sort of crazy about New World Pictures and the like. You know, they would, mm-hmm. you know, tell me, oh, did you ever see this film? Do you ever see this film? You know, that kind of thing. So it would maybe come up in conversation infrequently, of course. You know?
Yeah, it seems like it has no buzz anywhere, you know. It just... Is a few people know of it. Actually, because I wanted to see it at one point, I, together with a friend, though, purchased the VHS, the US VHS of it. Didn't cost me an arm and a leg, though, because it was not one of those, you know, bidding wars. Let's just say that it was a pretty easy getting this, I'm glad to have it sort of in my brain, because again, I'm amused by the idea of its existence, and I thought it was very, you know, well worth it to feature it as part of the Oshi coverage, but that's why we feature it in the bonus episode format, in the sort of optional in the optional extension of the show, and that's fine. I mean, it will never be rewatched. I don't need it.
No. Actually, one thing I wanted to add, one thing that I thought was good about the film, and you just mentioned it, was the VHS cover art is pretty cool.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, I've never seen the actual original VHS cover, but, you know, of course, it's on the internet. And when I looked at it, I was like, this might be kind of interesting. Maybe like a, you know, horror movie or bioterror type of movie, you know. And I reread the synopsis out of Brian's book, and I was just like, I bet you this is bait and switch time, you know? as we all know, you know, cover art can be very deceptive, you know. Yeah. So, and yes, that's certainly the case. And anyone who wants to check out that cover art, you know, of course, you just Google In the Aftermath VHS and you'll get it in Google Images.
the friend I bought it with is a German contact of mine, and he, I think he said that I have a literal translation or a loose translation of the German title, because apparently it was released on VHS in Germany, is something akin to After the Rabbit for some reason. And try and explain that, John, if you can. After the, I get it, rabbit?
Yeah, that's...
It's a bird. It's a feather. It's from a bird, not a rabbit.
That's more abstract than anything from the two films we talked about.
Yeah. So that's amusing in itself. But that's I guess, how we're going to end this coverage. Unless you had any other notes on this movie, John.
Actually, not on the film, but I did have one more note. And again, this is something that comes from Brian's book. Something I had actually forgotten. Mm-hmm. And it's another film that has a possibly indirect reference to Angel's Egg. It's a film from 1994 called The Mystery of Rompol, and it's based around the stories of the famous mystery and horror writer out of Japan called Edogawa Rompol. Mm-hmm. And there was a film, there have been many films that have been based on his works, but this 1994 piece is directed by Kazuyoshi Okuyama, and I believe it's called just Rompol in some regions, but mm-hmm. here in the U.S. it's called The Mystery of Rompol. But anyway, there is an intro piece, if I remember. It's been a long time since I've actually seen the film, and by the way, I would really recommend it to people to check out. But I believe it was an intro piece, and it's an animated piece that uses some visual motifs that are in Angel's Egg. So, for example, the eggs, and mm-hmm. there's water, and there's some fish in it, and it has a sort of, you know, again, there's a sort of possibly indirect reference to Angel's Egg, and mm-hmm. so I just want to mention that that's something that I read in again, this was Brian's book that mentioned it, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right, there was that little part of Mystery of Rompol. So I would recommend checking out that film, as well as actually, you know, if you are a book reader, check out anything by Edogawa Rompol, a really interesting writer who very much influenced a lot of modern day Japanese filmmakers and animators. And I would say that Rompol is a very, maybe not big influence, but he is definitely an influence on Japanese surrealist art, not only just film and animation, you know, but other things too. And I think a lot of, you know, a lot of the stuff that we as Westerners, when we see these, you know, Japanese films, that we go, whoa, that's weird or that's nutty, I think a lot of that comes from Rompol's mind. And some of his books have been translated into English and are available pretty readily on Amazon, etc. So, you know, definitely something to check out.
A recommendation came out of this podcast. A few.
Yeah. Not the film that we're talking about.
No, exactly.
Something.
Right. Well, this essentially runs off our bonus episode for Japan on Fire 6-1. So thanks for sticking with us through the entire Angel's Egg experience, I guess. And that's pretty much it. So I've been your host for this, Kenneth Bolson, and with me was Coffin John.
All right. Good night, everyone.